The following lecture by Dr. Gordon H. Clark is entitled, Is Christianity a Religion? Part 1.
The title of this chapter is Christianity a Religion? Is there such a thing as religion, of which Christianity is one manifestation? The question is important for two reasons. Its answer will influence and reveal what a person believes Christianity to be. And by the end of the chapter, we're going to give a definition of Christianity. I didn't ask that question in this introductory discussion, but you can be thinking of it. Maybe if you care, you could come up with a definition of Christianity and don't simply say it has something to do with historical events, period. That is not a sufficient definition of Christianity. Well, the question is important for two reasons. Its answer will influence and reveal what a person believes Christianity to be, and on a broader scale, it will determine the method that ought to be used in formulating a philosophy of religion. Therefore, let us ask the question a second time in a slightly different form. Is Christianity a species or a genus? Whether this is answered affirmatively or negatively, certain further problems are introduced. If Christianity is a species of the genus religion, how is religion defined, and what are Christianity's differentiating characteristics? If it is not, what sort of philosophy of religion can there be, and what sort of philosophy of Christianity can there be? Apparently, the first step in examining these questions must be the definition of religion. What is religion? Now, there's a question mark that comes at the end of this sentence, but I'm not sure any of you want to try to answer it, though if you're inspired, why just shout out at any, interrupt at any time. But the end of this paragraph is the question, what is religion? Well, I guess most of you are asleep, so I'll go on. Religion is familiar to the common man in every age and nation. He performs its simple or complicated rites. He believes its doctrines. However justified may be the orthodox complaint or the atheistic exaltation that a particular religion is losing its hold on the people, the ineradicable experiences still remain a familiar force. Among the learned, too, it is a familiar subject of discussion. Of the making of many books on the general subject of religion, the psychology of religion, the philosophy of religion, the history of religion, there is no end. But although religion is a phenomenon as multiform as it is familiar, both these characteristics contribute to the difficulty of understanding it. No one denies the multiformity. There is Christianity, there's Mohammedanism, and further there are Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, the religions of the interior of Africa, and of the Isles of the Sea. Yet notwithstanding their great differences, they are all popularly unified under the single term religion. Can such a unification survive scholarly analysis? Is it really possible to gather all these under one definition so that they can be discussed together as one subject? In botany, for example, the nightshade, the Indian cucumber root, we have to know some botany to do apologetics, don't we? Have you all had courses in botany? Well, maybe not here, but you're all college graduates, aren't you? So you had 2 or 3 years of botany in college, haven't you? You know what the internal flow of the what do you call it, like a Persian esculentum is, don't you? Sure. Beg pardon?
I wouldn't be surprised if you did in other terms.
Do any of you know what the Leica Persicon esculentum is? I don't suppose you know what internal phloem is, but you certainly know what the esculentum, whatever I said, Leica Persicon esculentum. I think you ate it last night for supper, dinner, whatever you call it. A tomato.
Oh, no.
Yes. But I appreciate your enthusiasm. But I'm not talking about the Leica Persicon esculentum. In botany, for example, the nightshade, the Indian cucumber root, the bellwort, the lily of the valley, Solomon's seal, asparagus, and the star of Bethlehem are all gathered together and discussed under the lily family. All the members of the lily family have certain characteristics in common, characteristics which tie them together in one family, and at the same time differentiate them from other families. Cannot the same thing be done for religions? You know, out west in Arizona, in the southern Arizona, in the deserts, there are cacti. And at this time of year, or within a few weeks now, the desert will not merely blossom like the rose, it'll much outdo the rose. For cacti flowers are far more beautiful than any roses are. And they are simply gorgeous. Now, if you go out there at the proper time, you will see a plant that goes about anywhere from 12 to 15 to 20 feet tall. Its name is the acacia. And it has beautiful red blooms on it. Well, one day I went into to a ranger station and looked at the exhibits there. And in one of the rooms on the wall, there was a painting, an oil painting, of an acacia. And of course, there were acacias growing outside. And underneath, among some other little bit of information on a placard, it says, "The acacia is not a cactus." It's something that an Easterner wouldn't guess, you know, because the acacia has thorns. You better be careful about touching it. And it, to the unaided eye, it looks very much like the other cacti. As I went to the ranger desk, and there was a man there, I said, "You have a picture in the other room there, nice painting of an acacia. And underneath it says it's not a cactus." "Oh yes," he says, "that's right, acacia is not a cactus." I said, "Would you please tell me what is a cactus?" He looked at me. Nobody has ever asked me that question before. Guess not many philosophers got there. He says, "I don't know." But the head ranger is coming back in just a few minutes. If you can wait, why, we'll ask him. I say, "Well, yes, I'm not in any hurry. Very beautiful. I just enjoy the view, you know." And, well, the main ranger did come back, and so I came up and I said, "Would you kindly tell me, sir, what is a cactus?" He says, "I don't know, but I'll look it up for you." And so he got out some of his books, and then he gave me a pretty fair statement of what a cactus is. I later found a better statement than the one, but he made a try. So you have to define your terms, you know. And in particular, when you're doing apologetics, you have to understand botany and know what a cactus is as opposed to an acacia, which isn't a cactus. I wish you can all go to Arizona this summer and see some acacias and some cacti. Let's see. You might even get so disgusted with this course that you'd leave early and get there in the middle of May, and I think you'd find more blooms in the middle of May than you'll still some find the 1st of June, but early May and middle of May is the best time to visit Arizona and pull this joke on the rangers because they don't know what cacti are. Now, you know what a tomato is, don't you? No, you don't. Tell the truth, neither do I. But asparagus is the same as an Easter lily. Not the same, it's the lily family. Now, is Christianity a species or a genus, a species of religion? Religion would be what is your question?
The question is, has to do with species, genus, and family. Does family come between genus and species?
No, it's family is yeah. But I wasn't using it in that very strict sense. I simply mean a lower class or a high. Is Christianity a subclass of the class religion? Now, religion may be a subclass of some higher class, some more extensive class. Well, now, wouldn't that be a good way of getting going in the subject? We talk about religion, don't we? And we say Islam is a religion, Judaism is a religion, Christianity is a religion. Well, if you know what religion is, then you can add the specific characteristics of Christianity and you get a definition of Christianity. Isn't that a good way of going about it? Sure, not. Beg pardon? Is it? Write down what you said and think about it tomorrow. As may be expected, this way of looking at the matter has been tried. Not only so, but it is the usual method of procedure. It seems to be only common sense. For example, Winston L. King, in his Introduction to Religion, and incidentally, if you read my books and if you generate sufficient enthusiasm, I would recommend that you look up my references to these various authors. It is very useful to have specific authors in mind and specific quotations rather than to give just general statements as somebody believes or a lot of people believe. If you say Winston L. King said this and put quotes on it, then nobody can come back at you. You have it definitely there and you can't be accused of being sloppy or otherwise. Winston L. King, in his Introduction to Religion, writes that religions are one as well as many. Although he makes the obscure denial that they have any common denominator of a neutral sort, there is, quote, some sort of unity, end quote, and there are, another quote, actual likenesses, end quote. At the end of 80 pages, he concludes, we have been trying to use the term religion, as well as religions, with the confidence that it has some distinguishing meaning. Such phrases as these, in an 80-page attempt to define religion, indicate the presence of difficulties. Apparently, botany is an easier subject than religion. But another author shows more confidence. You don't need 80 pages to define Lycopersicum esculentum or even cactus. Professor William E. Hocking in Living Religions and a World Faith commences by asserting that, quote, in its nature, religion is universal and one, end of quote. As a matter of fact, Hocking means more by this assertion than that religion is one in the sense that all the members of the Lilly family are one family. For he goes further and complains that the plurality of religions is a scandal to the religious man himself. And I suppose you've heard that objection time and time again. That's very common. The plurality of religions is a scandal to the religious man himself, to the philosopher, and to the statesman who wishes to unify his community. But why should it be a scandal? The plurality of lilies is no scandal to the botanist. Should the plurality of religions be scandalous to the philosopher? And however scandalous the plurality of religions may be to the statesman who wishes to unify his community, this very plurality may seem a blessing to freedom-loving individuals who think that some societies have been too thoroughly unified already. What can religion be if it is a more perfect unity than the generic unities of botany? Why should the unity of religion exclude specific differences? In a later volume, The Coming of World Civilization, in the later volume, Professor Hocking repeats his vigorous assertions of unity. In the fifth section of the book, to justify the identification of all religions in essence, he argues that, quote, affirmation is not exclusion, page 137. The Christian faith and a fortiori the Buddhist doctrine do not offer themselves as hypotheses competing with other hypotheses. Each one says, this is a way to peace. This is all quotation from Hocking. Each one says, this is a way to peace. And such an affirmation does not exclude other ways. In a sense, there is an only way, but it is not the only way of a particular religion. It is a universal way. The essence of the precepts and doctrines that mystics in all religions have discerned is the same. The agreements are not even mere similarities. They are identities. Thus, the only way is not the way that marks off one religion from another, but it is the way already present in all. The several universal religions are already fused together, so to speak, at the top. End of quote. In the last few words, he has italicized, namely that they're already fused together, so to speak, at the top. Do any of you know anything about Professor Hocking? He was quite well known back in the 30s or 20s. What very definite results happened from some of his writings? Well, wasn't he the man that pretty well smashed up the evangelical missionary enterprise?
I don't know anything about him.
Wasn't he the author of Rethinking Missions? And hence he pretty much wrecked the preaching of the gospel in foreign nations? Well, all right. Can't know everything. Naturally, such a view stimulates many questions. For example, it may be asked, does Hocking base his statements on an empirical study of several religions? Is this what the religions assert or admit? How does Hocking obtain the conclusion that the doctrine of all religions are essentially identical? If this is only what some mystics in every religion say, Can the student of religion accept the mystical evaluation and disregard what other members of the same religion assert? It is undeniable, at least, that Hawking's principle, quote, affirmation is not exclusion, is in conflict with the explicit teachings of some religions. Christ's statement in the Gospel, no man cometh unto the Father but by me, is decisively exclusive. Similarly, the apostle said, there is none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. Hawking would have to hold that Christ is not essential to Christianity. But of course, this criticism is premature, for at the beginning it seems reasonable, especially for one who is writing a book on religion, to assume that there must be some sort of unity, either a generic unity or some still deeper kind, that makes religion a single subject of discussion. Now we come to a subhead. The previous subhead was unity and multiplicity. That is there such a unitary thing as religion of which there are multiple examples? Now then, this problem, which is briefly surveyed, raises a disconcerting disjunction. Promising and even necessary though this principle may appear, its application is already seen to be attended with great difficulty. Perhaps the very familiarity of religious experience is one cause of its stubborn defiance of analysis. At any rate, a comparison of the many volumes on religion discloses a disconcerting disjunction. Either, in spite of the similarity of titles, the authors are not writing about the same subjects, or, in spite of the length of the books and their learned vocabulary, they do not know what they are writing about. The first half of this disjunction reflects those authors who, like King, whom I quoted a couple pages ago, the first half of this disjunction reflects those authors who, like King, frankly, courageously, and commendably formulate an explicit definition of religion. A frank attempt is reasonable because one expects a writer to state what subject he intends to study. But a quick survey of these definitions shows that the more definite the authors are, the more obviously they're not talking about the same thing. King virtually includes a belief in God in his definition. At least, he spells object of devotion with a capital O, and further emphasizes it in the following chapter, pages 74 and following. So King regards God as an element in the definition of religion. Julian Huxley, on the other hand, in Religion Without Revelation, says that the essential religious reality is not God, but a sense of the sacred, which, like the feeling of hunger or the emotion of anger, is irreducible. Although this latter definition is not so definite in its affirmation as it is in its denial, it is still definite enough to see that King and Huxley are not talking about the same thing when they use the term religion. There are other humanistic definitions of religion that may be taken as vague or definite, depending on how one looks at them. The Humanist Manifesto, that's the original one back in the 30s, not the more recent one that came out. Was in the 60s or was it in the 70s? 73. The Humanist Manifesto constitutes religion of those actions, purposes, and experiences which are humanly significant. Now, this may be vague and meaningless, but if it is taken at literal face value and assigned an intelligible meaning, an interesting question comes to the fore. Is not an appendectomy humanly significant? Then it follows that appendectomies are religious exercises. It is evident, therefore, that what the humanists call religion is not the same that other authors are discussing. Once more, William James was definite enough when he spoke of religion as the experiences of men in their solitude. But other writers are definite in defining religion as social. All the devout worshiper and the devout worshiper in any of the several religions might not like any of these definitions. Clearly, what one man calls religion, another does not recognize as such. The more definite the definition is, the more clearly the writers are not writing on the same subject. This difficulty gives rise to the second half of the disjunction. Some writers do not know what they're writing about. They recognize the impossibility of defining religion and rely on its familiarity to satisfy the reader. L. W. Grenstead in The Psychology of Religion, and oh, there must be hundreds or thousands of books on the psychology of religion. Grenstead remarks in his foreword that the subject is nebulous and ill-defined. No one part of it has any clear logic or scientific priority. Quote, there is always a lurking doubt whether religion is a proper study for psychology at all. End of quote. And a page or two later, he adds, quote, the definition of religion is impossible. Thus, the only means of saying what we mean by religion must be empirical, descriptive, and accumulative. We must, in fact, return to what ordinary folk understand by religious behavior. End of quote, page 15. This initial admission of failure, however, does not prevent the gentleman from writing his book, a humorous paradox that he himself seems to enjoy. Every so often he acknowledges that he doesn't know what he's writing about. He says, that's fun. Now, there are powerful reasons for accepting the position that religion cannot be defined. In fact, such is the main conclusion of this chapter. One of the criticisms that some of my students make of me is they can't tell when I'm giving my own opinions and when I'm giving the opinions of other people. That's because they don't listen carefully, but that seems to be an occupational hazard of students. I'll warn you now, I'm giving my own opinion in these two or three lines anyhow. There are powerful reasons for accepting the position that religion cannot be defined, such as the main conclusion of this chapter. It will be shown definitely that we cannot with confidence, to repeat a phrase from King, we cannot assume that religion has a distinguishable meaning. This conclusion sometimes leads to the clear-sighted muddle-headedness of Grenstead. There is, however, another alternative to be mentioned later. But for the moment, and particularly the opening of the discussion, one should not merely assume the impossibility of defining religion. It is better to examine the two chief methods used in attempting to frame a definition, and if in doing so we are fairly convinced that the problem is insoluble, we shall have learned the precise reasons for the failure. So I'm going to give two different methods that have been used to define religion, and show why both of them fail.
Please turn the tape for the continuation of this lecture.
The second method, based on examining the multiformity of Mohammedanism, Shintoism, Buddhism, and so on, may be named the comparative method. But the first to be considered is the psychological approach, based on the intimate familiarity of the experience. And now there are some subheads under the general title of the psychological approach. The first subhead is emotion versus intellect. There are many persons, both scholars and others, who believe that the essence of religion, the common factor in all religions, is some sort of emotional experience. In one way or another, they minimize the intellectual content. Although Hawking speaks of a search for righteousness, and righteousness no doubt is something other than emotion, Hawking's stress falls on the passionateness of the search rather than on the contents of righteousness. Now, what famous author can you think of who depends a great deal on passion? Yes, I'm glad you've heard of Kierkegaard, dear old fellow. We'll have something to say about him, too. Nothing commendatory, of course, but... He stresses the passionateness of the search rather than the contents of righteousness. He does not make an outright denial that there are intellectual factors in religion, but he asserts that no theoretical proposition is true apart from feeling. This seems to imply that even the truth of mathematics depends on feeling. 2 + 2 = 4 is quite an emotional experience, you know. Perhaps he would not say that all passion is religious or commendable, but passion is so much the medium of religion that whatever is a passion tends to be religious. King also emphasizes the emotional nature of religion and disparages the intellectual. That's King as opposed to Hawking. In his foreword, he refers to, quote, the bare bones of the intellectual statements of religious dogma, end quote, as opposed to, and this the rest is a quote, opposed to the vital phenomena of breathing and moving religions themselves. Yes.
When he said, when you mentioned here that he asserts that no theoretical proposition is true apart from feeling, wasn't he, I'm asking, wasn't he limiting that to statements about religion?
Well, no, I don't think so. Because, you see, he talks about the passion in the matter of religion, then he realizes that there are some people might say, well, there's some passions that are not very religious. Now, he doesn't exactly deny that, but he tries to minimize it by saying all passion is so much the medium of religion that whatever is a passion, and this might be some very nasty, angry plot, whatever is a passion tends to be religious. So he doesn't want to say outright that all passions are religious. But he does say all passions at least tend to be religious. And this is a modification of his first statement to take care of some instances of passion where most people would say it's not religious. And he says, well, no, it really isn't religious, but it tends to be. It's on the way to becoming religious. No, I think he meant it that way. Of course, you can interpret it as you please, but that's the conclusion I came to. And then King says, he makes the comparison or the contrast between the bare bones of the intellectual statements of religious dogma as opposed to the vital phenomena of breathing and moving religions themselves. And I can show you lots of so-called devotional books that follow that line. I guess you've all read them. They get rather tiring and boring after a while. Or consider a little more at length the views of another well-known scholar who places the emphasis on emotion. James Bissett Pratt, I don't suppose many of you have heard of him, but he was a very well-known scholar at the beginning of this century, or early in this century, and his book had a tremendous influence. The book, the title is The Religious Consciousness. Now, Pratt, aware of the difficulties in framing a definition, admits that in many respects his own definition is probably as bad as any other. But he holds that one word in it hits the mark pretty accurately. Religion, he says, is a serious attitude toward those powers which people believe control their destinies. It is the word attitude which he stresses, and by which he plays down the intellect. In his study of conversion, he states, quote, "The essential thing about conversion is the unification of character," end of quote. And that this is, quote, "it's the really important and only essential part of it. The unification of character is the important and only essential part of religion." Page 123. And continuing verbatim quotation, "This involves will, emotion, and thought, but it is primarily moral." Continuing the quote, "Nor is the intellectual side of the process to be neglected, though it is frankly the least noticeable of the three. In most cases," this is still verbatim quotation, "in most cases, it seems to play but a negative part." Well, he doesn't rule out intellect completely, but he says it's a negative part, and it's not very important. It doesn't make any much importance what you believe. You have to believe something, but it doesn't make much difference. The thing is to believe it passionately, which is somewhat similar to, but not completely the same as Kierkegaard. And now we have a little subhead on preconceived notions. At the risk of anticipating too much of the later argument, it might be best even at this point to question whether all unification of purpose or character is religious. As one example of conversion, Pratt chooses the experience of a certain Ardigo, who renounced the Roman Catholic priesthood to become a positivistic scientist. Now, this is no doubt a conversion of a sort, but is it a religious conversion? Of course, the answer to this question depends on one's definition of religion. Pratt defends his choice of examples on the ground that he has not permitted preconceived notions derived from Christian theology to influence him. Presumably, to choose as examples of conversion only those instances which accord with Christian theology, to do that would be to forfeit the claim to scientific objectivity. At the same time, although Pratt may not have selected the material from the standpoint of any one of the well-known world religions, he nonetheless makes his selection on the basis of other preconceived principles, which can be thought of as his private religion. From a logical standpoint, it is equal whether one's assumptions are philosophical or theological, Christian or not. If it is reprehensible to operate on Christian presuppositions, is it any less so on other presuppositions? The only difference would seem to be that the writer with Christian principles is probably more aware of the fact, while the scientific writer sometimes claims he has no preconceived notions at all. In other words, Pratt, attempting to avoid the bias of a Christian view of conversion, does not seem to be aware of his own bias in assuming Ardigo's conversion was a religious conversion, and that the essence of religion is the unification of character. I'm trying to get across to you the idea that the definition of terms is important. You ought to know what you are talking about. Of course, that sometimes restricts the conversation to a very little bit. But to make any real progress, you have to know what you're talking about, whether it's out, Sive, or Vel. Otherwise, you don't say anything clear enough for other people to understand. And I guess you might say you're not thinking clearly enough for you to understand what you're saying yourself. And so I am working up to a definition of Christianity in the JS.
You said that Pratt considers that he's avoided the problem of preconceived notions that have a Christian theistic basis.
Yeah.
But you say he also has his own preconceived notions?
Obviously.
Okay, and what? How would you classify them as?
Well, he has a notion of conversion, which allows him to say that Ardigo's conversion was a religious conversion. Now, most people, at any rate, would not suppose that a man who left the Roman priesthood to become a positivistic scientist was converted. They wouldn't use that language. They wouldn't say he changed his mind or something or other, he gave up religion and became a scientist, something like this. But they wouldn't call it a conversion. But Pratt's definition of a conversion includes that. Now then, he has a certain presupposition in his notion of what conversion is. And he rejects the Christian concept of conversion. He has a different concept of conversion, which allows him to include Ardigo. And so he is using certain presuppositions, certain bias, although he rejects a different bias. But he thinks he has no bias. Yes?
Would it not be the case that any definition is, I mean, like, for instance, of lilies, we apply criterion, which are they not just essentially arbitrary, having to do with breeding characteristics and such?
Yes,
because... Could I define religion however I felt like it, and that would be...
Yes, because a 4-inch nail and a 4-inch worm belong to the same species.
What do you...
I thought we talked about 4-inch nails a little bit ago.
Right.
Well?
Okay. I'm saying that in biology, species is defined by certain characteristics.
Yes.
Okay. Those characteristics are essentially, I mean, they're chosen by somebody and they're commonly agreed upon.
Yeah.
But in the same way, couldn't we, I mean, just assuming that, you know, Pratt has a definition for it, if everyone were to agree that the essence of religion is conversion as he understands it, would that not then define religion?
That would be his definition of religion, yes, that's right. So you see, botany and zoology are essential to Christian apologetics. And you have to know the difference between a tomato and a whale, for example.
From within your own presuppositional worldview, then, would you ever refer to such systems as Islam, Judaism, as religions?
Oh, I might use the word. We talk colloquially all the time, you know. But if you want technique, no. Because working up to the definition of Christianity, one of my points is there is no such thing as religion.
All right.
Of course, that sounds sort of queer, but I am queer.
All right. I want to ask you a further question then. It sounds like somebody might object and say that, you know, you're just being provincial, sort of like a baseball player looking upon basketball, soccer, and football, and saying that those are so patently inferior to my sport that they can't fall under the general rubric of sports.
Yeah, that's right.
And so,
but my reply is, the basketball player is just as narrow as the baseball player, because the basketball player says baseball isn't a sport. To put it more generally, as I'm working up to it, you can't avoid presuppositions. You probably have, a good many of you have heard some of my views, and you understand, of course, that I am a presuppositionalist, but I am trying to show why I am. And part of that is to show that everybody else is too, even though they say they're not.
What if we had a generic basketball player who did say that baseball is a sport also?
Well, he has a different definition of sport.
From a common sense view, wouldn't we say that the definition is more accurate?
Yes, and from a common sense view, why Judaism is a religion. But when you come down to being technical and accurate, you can't define religion and make it fit to... Well, I'll give you... I'm working up the reasons why you can't define religion.
So in the Christian system, you have the same difficulty because there's so many different competing systems under the head of Christianity.
And I'm going to give my definition, yes. But the Roman Catholic will give his definition, and his definition of Christianity is not the same as mine. He has his presuppositions, I have other ones. And as for not defining religion, I am analyzing the two methods that have been used to define religion, one psychological and the other we call comparative religions. And I want to show that both those methods fail. And since they fail, you have to start some other way. And, of course, I start the way I prefer to. So does everybody else. Yes. Well, either one. I don't...
Well, it is, but you say then that the definition that the use of the word religion, that it's an illicit use, if it has no valid definition, and we ought to understand...
Please don't use the word valid when you're talking about something that can't possibly be valid.
Well, in other words... It's
proper, if you wish...
Okay, proper, appropriate.
Appropriate.
Okay. If there's no appropriate definition, if we can't even formulate a definition of religion, then are you saying that we shouldn't use the word religion?
It's very hard to avoid it. As I go on to point out, the colloquial use is confused. And... One of the things I'm coming to is if you ask people in general without being technical in a classroom, ask them whether communism is a religion. Most people say no, it's anti-religious. But then you can point out factors in communism and say, oh yes, it is a religion. And this indicates the confusion in the popular usage of the word. But I don't think that anyone can stop the English-speaking people from using the word religion.
Well, wouldn't it make sense to begin from the fact that people use it and try to communicate with them individually on the basis of how they use that word in terms?
But you may start there, but when you find out they don't mean the same thing, and their usage conflicts
with
the usage of other people. I mean that there are many inconsistent usages of the word, then you are forced to say what you mean. And when you say what you mean, you're going to exclude some usages.
So the burden that you're trying to say is that we should push people to clarify what they mean when they say
exactly.
The term religion.
Yeah. For instance, is Shintoism, is that a religion or is it politics? Well, the same thing communism, but... there are other things, too.
Yeah. It seems to me it just depends on how you choose to use the word. You know, if you choose to use the word in certain ways, then you can say that it is religion.
If you will take the trouble to look up words in Merriam-Webster's Unabridged Dictionary, you will find that most words in the English language have four or five different meanings. And in that case, unless a person makes clear what he means, the other person doesn't know what he's talking about. That's why I said the fast horse is tied fast. Now here you have the same word with completely opposite meanings.
Right. So it seemed to me that the point should be just to clarify what we're saying rather than not to use the word. Yes.
If you can, yeah. I am going to argue you can't use the word religion, no matter how you clarify it, so that you can include say, Judaism, Christianity, and communism, or Judaism, Christianity, and exclude communism. I want to show that these two methods, and they're really the only two that have actually been used, these two methods fail. Yes?
Aren't you trying, in your definition of religion, from the beginning you said, you know, between a genus and a species, aren't you trying to narrow down that religion to a very, very specific genus, whereas, at least the way I understand that botany and biology use the term genus, it refers to a certain group of things, like you listed the asparagus and the lily and the star of Bethlehem, that have certain characteristics, but they do not have all the same characteristics. They have a general...
Well, in the case of a cactus,
they had five common things, but yeah. I'm sure they had a wide variety of things that were different.
No, but anything that has those five is a cactus.
Yeah, but couldn't you form a definition of
well,
religion?
That makes the definition of cactus.
Yeah, but what I understand you're saying about religion is you want to narrow it down so that you have to have a wide variety of points that make. So that each view would fit into that definition, whereas...
I want to get, say, five or some number. To define religion, you have to get five characteristics which are found in everything you call religion. Now, of course, there may be other characteristics of the various religions because there are various types of cacti. But anything that has those five is a cactus, whatever other characteristics they may have. And if you could define religion, you would have to put down a certain number of criteria, and anything that fit those criteria would be a religion. And I wish to show you what the trouble is if you try to do that.
What is the minimum number of characteristics that you need to make? If there was one common characteristic, could you make that easy?
That would give a very wide genus, I guess.
Like 4 inches of male.
Well, that's sort of artificial, but yes, it's possible now.
Well, are you saying then that anytime we can't give necessary and sufficient conditions when using a
word? Those two words are very good.
That
necessary and sufficient. Yeah.
So if we can't give the necessary and sufficient conditions of a proper definition of a term, then there's no way we can really meaningfully use that term?
That's right, yeah.
Well,
if you don't have those necessary and sufficient conditions, you don't know what you're talking about.
Well, let's say, for example, that one of the necessary and sufficient conditions is the definition of the word chair.
Well, I really don't know.
I guess I'm saying that, I mean, I've been in situations where we kick that around and nobody has seemed to come up with anything that doesn't break down somewhere. Yet we very meaningfully all the time use the word chair. People know what we're talking about.
No, they don't have a very accurate idea of what you're meaning.
In a specific context, they know what we're talking
about. Well, of course, then of course you have unexpressed meanings that you take for granted. That often happens, of course.
Yeah.
But... I quite agree with you that it would be exceptionally difficult to define chair. The nearest you could come is it's something you sit on, but then that includes a rock.
Or a beach.
Yeah. Well, no, you would have to define something you sit on so that your legs can be bent at right angles. So the beach wouldn't do.
Yeah, but neither would one of those chairs on the beach that you put your feet out all the way.
You mean like a deck chair?
Right, but not the chair. You know?
Well, the deck chair does raise up, so it went. I know. That's the difficulty. And just the one.
Dr. Fox, the study of semantics then and word means and diachronistic and synchronistic relationships of words, that wouldn't have any. That wouldn't be very helpful to us then in apologetics. Unless we understood beforehand, you know, what either we had agreed on definitions or we just abandoned definitions and accepted basic.
I am glad you now recognize that linguistics is an essential part of Christian apologetics. just as Einstein's relativity is.
That's why I couldn't give you the definition of religion, because I wasn't sure if it was going to be the same.
Well, you remember I said some people want to restrict apologetics to a relatively narrow field. And my notion, whether you accept it or not, that's something else, but my notion makes it rather wide. That is, I want to include Einstein and the matter of language. Now wait, there was one here that somebody, yes, was it you?
Well, I'm still having trouble in seeing what, the way I understand genus is that it is not supposed to be, you know, getting back to the chair. If we talk about the genus chair, it is going to be very hard for us to do. To visualize what a chair is, because
never mind visualizing it.
Or,
I don't think you can.
Or perceive.
No, understand.
Understand
a
what,
state.
What the idea of a chair is.
No.
And I don't think a genus is it's supposed to. I think a genus is a general category. Like if I tell you, well, what is the genus of Lily? You may have. Ideas of a species of a lily, but not of the genus of
well,
the family lily.
I don't know enough botany to answer that question correctly, but guessing, and I rather think my guess will be technically incorrect, I would say the genus lily is a subclass of the general notion of plant. Now, I rather suspect there are some intervening definitions in there, but I don't know them. You see, you have the Star of Bethlehem, and that is one under the genus Lily, and Lily is something under a higher group, which may be plant, but I suspect there's some intermediate terms in there, too. Now, let me just...
You said earlier... In response to another question of mine, that you presuppose Christianity because you prefer Christianity, and you define Christianity. All right. Why do you prefer it? Do you have reason to prefer Christianity?
I will take up that question in detail as we go on. I'm not dodging your question, at least I'm dodging it for the moment. But I'm not going to forget it. But I want to be very specific and state the criteria, yes. Yes. Yeah.
You know, I guess that's in relation to the question that keeps haunting me is, does that have to do with the exclusiveness of Christianity?
Oh, yes, that's right.
And so, in other words, maybe I'm jumping the gun by trying to... I kind of... It's haunting me because
quite all right.
It's a question that I've never had answered.
Well,
succinctly by anyone. I will
try to give you an answer. But... you see, if I am so persnickety as to require strict definitions, I have to impose that limitation on myself, and to do so, I have to take things up technically one at a time, and I can't say everything in 15 minutes. But you're on the subject, don't you? Yeah, that's fine. Only I'm not ready to answer that question yet.
Okay.
I'm not dodging it eventually. In fact, I want to make it as clear as I can. But... I have to produce a certain amount of background. Yes.
As you used the word religion this morning, has any meaningful communication taken place?
Oh, it's only vague. Yes. When you use the term religion in colloquial language, you mean Buddhism, Judaism, a few things like that. And that's simply colloquial and not very definite. As I say, take the word conversion. Most Christians would not say that Ardigo's change from the Roman priesthood to positivistic science was a conversion in any religious sense. But this fellow does.